This is Ben Hodges, recorded at his home in Sheffield on the 1st of August 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Ben Hodges, Part 1.
The full name is Ben Hodges. I was Chris and Ben. My father was Benjamin. So they christened me Ben. I was born in Sheffield in 1936, 15th of July,
1936. So you're now 70...
73.
73. Tell me about life before the Antarctic. What were you up to?
Well, before Antarctica, I didn't even know where Antarctica was. It never cropped up in my vocabulary and other people that I've spoken to. But when I reached 18 years old, of course, that's conscription to do national service. This I quite enjoyed receiving at the age of 18. And we did training at Catterick for a few months and then flown out to the Canal Zone. And I spent the rest of the time escaping from the Canal Zone with one or two enemies chasing us, you know.
Panama or Suez?
Suez, right. Suez, yes. We finished up being driven out and to a place near Tobruk and then flown across to Cyprus. And then, for some reason, I don't know why, it was a troop. It was only maybe 30, 40 men. We've flown across to Amman, because we could go from Amman quite safely. And we went into Syria and traversed to Baghdad, where we flew back to UK at the end of the service. But it was quite hairy. And we never fired a shot in anger. But we were at one stage being faced by Syrian tanks when we crossed into the Syrian border. And we were digging in as we moved along.
Did you at any time fear for your life?
No, I don't think so. I'd never been fired at, never been shot at. But the Arabs have a strange reputation for that kind of warfare. Yeah, I never had to fire a shot in anger. I could fire the shots because that's what we were trained to do.
So a lot of posturing going on.
Yes, I would. Yeah, the tanks looked very aggressive, but nothing happened, so we could move on.
And how did you get out of the army? Your time came up.
Yes, it was my 2 years finished when a little bit over the 2 years when I got back to UK.
Did you have any plans at that point, Ben?
No, other than go back home and see what was on the go, on the cards. I then found scaffolding quite interesting. So for a couple of years, I was a scaffolder, quite high-rise stuff. And then steel erecting came along. I'd been taught to do a bit of welding and a bit of installing overhead electric cranes in the workshops in Sheffield. And steel erecting just kind of fizzled out a little bit. I was just getting a little bit fed up. And I saw a steeplejacks advert. In those days, in the 50s, there was a building trades newspaper used to come out once a week. They called it the Construction News. And I saw this little advert, steeplejack wanted, phone so-and-so. So I went along with that, and I was a steeplejack, maybe for 18 months. Nothing more than that.
What is it about the sky that was attracting you?
Well, how did I come about? When I saw this advert in Construction News saying that they wanted, I forget what it was an organisation down in London, wanted two steel erectors to spend the summer season and build a small aircraft hangar at one of the bases. So I thought, well, that sounds interesting. So when I got home, I looked in the atlas. Now, where is Antarctica? And I thought, well, all that way and get paid, and you know. So I went down for an interview with the Crown agents in London, Bill Sloman, who's no longer with us now. I remember being interviewed by Bill, and he says, well, you know this. It does snow a lot down in Antarctica. What happens when you've got so far with the building of it and the thing gets all covered with snow? So I said, well, we'd have to just kind of dig it out and pick it up from there. But he says, but what if it happens again, say a week later? So I said, well, if we're going to build a hangar, well, you know, we'd better do the same again, dig it out and carry on. And he asked me that three times. I don't think he was cared. He didn't think he was, that I was, what was I going to say? That as long as I could shovel snow, he's prepared to give me a job.
And so, in fact, you weren't going to give up.
Well, no, I wanted, really wanted to go, and I hadn't known there was another steel erector there yet. But they got a guy who'd just worked on the one of the bridges in New Zealand, and he was first rate, first class. He taught me an awful lot, and he wasn't going to stay. He was only going to stay for the summer season, and I'd heard about husky dog teams and things like further south. And I said, well, could I stay the winter? I could get a little bit more done before the snows come, and I can perhaps make an early start if they send another steel erector down. Because I wanted to go further south and sample what happened in the dog team area. And that's what actually happened. I stayed the winter at Deception, did get a little bit more done. The other steel erector went home at the end of that summer season. That was it for him. And I got moved down. I said, the hangar's finished now because I put some extra bits in which I could handle on my own and sort of help from base.
At Deception,
yeah. And what was I going to say then?
And you talked them into letting you go further south?
That's right, yes. I said I'd wintered at Deception as well. And I think that put me in good stead for going further south. And I finished up at Stonington.
Let me just ask you a few questions pertaining to what we've just been talking about. Let's go back to the steel erecting and steeplejack work. What was it that attracted you to that kind of thing?
Well, if you can see that a scaffold is working up the side of a building, which was easy. You worked in a team of two or three, you know, pulling all the scaffold poles up, erecting them and, you know, just building the building. Then I saw the steel erecting job, and I thought, well, I'll have a bash at that, and that was okay. And then in this construction newspaper, there was this advert for two steel erectors wanted in Antarctica.
But you were keen to travel, were you? Was that the attraction?
Yes, I was. Yeah, I was a footloose and fancy free. I wasn't leaving a girlfriend behind or anything like that. And I knew my mum and dad would be a little bit worried about this kind of thing, but I was an adult and I'd mixed with real men, and that's where I got asked to come and be interviewed down at Crown Agents in London. It was Bill Sloman.
When you looked on the map and discovered where the Antarctic was, did it make you more enthusiastic?
Oh, yes, it did indeed.
Oh,
yeah.
It did?
Yeah. I knew there was a North Pole and a South Pole, but when you see the continent there, off the tip of South America, do you think? Yes.
Had you read about Scott and Amundsen?
No, not then. No. I've read about those guys later.
Shackleton,
the boss. Yeah. Yeah. Because I spent some time at South Georgia as well.
We'll come to that in due course. Mm. Give me. So you arrived at Deception in the autumn of 61.
Sailed in 1960.
Yeah.
From Southampton on a very small ship.
John Biscoe?
No, not John Biscoe, the Shackleton, RRS Shackleton, I think it was. Yeah. Very, very small, with a crew of about six, and three, myself and two other chaps were going down to join the survey. They'd been selected, and the other steel erector, he came as well.
What was his name?
Pete Secker.
Are you still in touch, or is he?
No, that was the last I heard of Pete when he left and I went south.
Right.
And we sailed. We on the way down, we called at Tristan da Cunha, and we picked up two Tristan da Cunhas, which we were going to take to Port Stanley to work in Port Stanley. And from there, we then went down to the base.
What kind of sailor were you?
Terrible sailor on the first. It must have taken me 10 days to get my sea legs.
Mm.
And they were saying, who's that chap there that's just turned up? But I was very, very sick and very, never been at sea before. I've been in aeroplanes and all that kind of thing, but never at sea. And it did take its toll for that first week, 10 days. But I'd beaten it by then.
And you were committed, of course.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's of course. Yeah.
Are you the sort of guy who wouldn't back out?
I was certainly more, I'd like to escape from the seasickness. It's awful. But I wouldn't have backed out now.
So you got to, I presume you were called at Stanley, did you?
Yeah, we all got it. We call it Montevideo as well. Tristan da Cunha was a real bonus thing, but we always the chief steward, always revictualled at Montevideo, you know, and topped up the ship with fresh food, and he knew where to go, you know, to buy this kind of stuff. And he always had a few beers in his den. You know, he had a few beers, and then. What happened, people would be, the bus personnel was starting to take more and more alcohol down south, and that got a bit frowned upon because, you know, people got drunk and this, that, and the other.
And who was frowning?
Well, the establishment, because it would have been reported back by, say, either captain or what's it, that three of these guys have bought crates of whiskey and a dozen parcels of beer, this, that, and the other. And so the survey, you know, put a bit of a block on that, you know, the ration, you know, what you could take.
So they were buying booze in Montevideo. They were, to take to their base.
That's right, yeah. Buying it from
the purser.
The purser, yes, that's right.
Oh, I see. Right. And did Fuchs, was it Fuchs who found out about that?
I don't know. It would be someone back at London. And they said, you know, you've got to watch, and they can only take so much, you know, two bottles of whiskey. But there was always a little bit of whiskey on base and beer for midwinter's day. But you know, when they realised that fellas were getting pretty keel-eyed, then they put a stop to that.
So you got to Port Stanley in the Falklands.
Yeah. We got all the polar kit then.
Oh, right. You're kitted out there.
Kitted out there, yeah. A lot of it was ex-army stuff. You know, thick shirts, underwear, long johns and all that business. Winterproof, ventile, ventile's very, very good for keeping the wind out. And the weave, when it gets wet, swells and keeps the water, keeps the moisture out as well. So we got all that gear for whichever base you were going to. We'd probably be in Stanley for, I don't know, for a week, so...
And then they set you off for deception.
Yeah.
What was your first impression when you...
Excitement, I'm really excited. It's because it's a summer season, a lot of the snow's gone, and Deception Island is just a horseshoe of a ring with two volcano calderas, which one was the Whaler's Bay, which was the small one that erupted years and years and years ago, and one was Port Foster, which was the other one. And the Neptune's Bellows were the entrance to this magic island, so to speak. If you could sail all the way around, you'd be faced with ice cliffs and a few glaciers and rock faces. But the bellows, Neptune's Bellows, with a wrecked whale catcher run aground in one side some years ago, that was on this ledge, partially exposed, and sailed into the Whaler's Bay, which where there was the I think it was Norwegians who ran a whaling station there, shore station, for about 11 years, I think, before they moved out.
This was your first sight of what was going to be home?
Yes, it was, yeah.
Were you impressed or surprised? Or?
I was pleased. I was quite pleased. It was still an adventure. And we had to get the hangar done, you know, and we dug in and worked hard.
Well, tell me about the hangar. Were you building it from scratch?
Yes. It had been prefabricated in UK.
Right.
And it was like just a jigsaw puzzle, just to put together. It wasn't sheeted. There was no sheets to cover it, which that's what they wanted. But they followed down the year after that, and they sent a couple of sheeters down to sheet it up.
So you were building the skeleton?
We were building the skeleton, yeah. Pete. Yes, that's right. Yeah. Pete went and I finished some other bits off, which one man can manage with a chain block. And with help from base as well.
Was it hard work or...? straightforward?
Well, I slipped a disc during that period, and I got laid up, and I was actually sent back to Stanley just to sleep it off, so to speak, which was a big blow to me. But it gradually got better and better and better, and I did manage to persuade the survey that give me another chance to go down to Deception and see what happens, and I was fine.
So how long were you laid up for?
It must have been 2 or 3 months.
Oh, right.
Yeah, before while the ships were still getting backwards and forwards. It wasn't as long as that. 1 to 2 months, I think.
So when you... Were you in a hospital in Stanley?
Yes, I was, yeah.
What was that like in those days?
It was a small hospital, small cottage hospital. I forget the name of it. But it was fine. It's fine, about 6 to a ward. There were mixed wards as well, which was a little bit embarrassing, I suppose.
And the nurse, did you feel it was a competently run place? Was it?
Yeah, it was all right. The nurses were very attentive, and the doctor would come around and say, "How are you feeling now? Let's see what you can do." And in the end, I just got up and walked.
You didn't discharge yourself, did you?
No, I didn't. No. I know. I was allowed to go back to Deception.
Who did you have to persuade to be allowed to go back?
That'd be the adder on. In Stanley, they had a base office with one or two ex-FIDs who were now part of the management. What was the question?
Who did he have to persuade to allow you to go back? Who did he have to get permission from?
I can't really remember that. Oh. That must have been through the management at Port Stanley.
Back to London?
Back to London, yeah.
I see. So when he got back to Deception again after your layoff, had Pete done lots of work?
He'd gone. He went home on the ship the season that I came out of Antarctica.
So what was the state of the hangar?
It was just a skeleton then.
Complete?
Yeah. It was going to be a skeleton anyway because there was no sheeting for it.
Was it a complete skeleton?
Yes, it was, yeah.
And it couldn't
be used.
No. How many aircraft was it designed to...
Two, I think. De Havilland Otters.
So it remained in a skeletal state all winter, effectively?
It's still in fine shape now, just as a skeleton. Because there was I came south, a few times as well, in South Georgia and places like that. And I went down with an American friend, and we were doing a survey of South Georgia to try and ascertain how much weight of ferrous and non-ferrous scrap to be offered to a international scrap dealer to clear the site, take all that stuff away for nothing, and leave a clean field site. But that never happened. Mm. Never happened.
There's a chap called Dan...
Weinstein.
Weinstein?
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
W-E-I or I-E, Weinstein.
E-I.
N-S-T-E-I-N, I think.
Right.
We became good friends, actually.
That was a bit later on in the story, though, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah.
So, obviously, at some point, you couldn't do any more steel work because it would be too cold.
All the little bits and pieces are finished. The doors on the hangar were sliding doors, big doors. But they could be built and put up with a block and tackle, yeah. And they were fitted. They could fitted to close and open. And it was just waiting for the sheets.
So what did you do in the winter when you couldn't do any more hangar work?
Well, they retired old dogs from the sledging base to Deception. So there's always a few dogs on base. And they're a bit unruly. And, you know, we were all new guys down there. But John Killingbeck, a very good friend of mine, who was the base leader or base commander, we always called them base leaders, we tried very hard with the dogs. And we actually took them round the edge of the island, all the way around. We dropped over to meet with the Argentinians and then travelled around what snow was there on the edge, round to meet the Chileans. And then back round to Whalers Bay, the entrance, and we were boated back across. The sea ice had gone out and we were boated across back to Deception.
With the dogs?
With the dogs, yeah.
So you took to dogs, did you, Ben?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah, very much so. Particularly when I got my own team, when I went to Stonington.
So let's try and do things chronologically.
Okay, right.
So here we are in the middle of winter.
Yeah.
On deception, your first winter. Yeah. There's no real work to be done.
No.
Did the dogs occupy all your time?
No, not all the time. You take them out for exercise and take them out for runs. Try and lay in a seal stock as well. Mm. You know, because we used to kill seal for dog meat. And also we used to eat some of the seal meat as well, ourselves as well. So we didn't get very far at deception. You could venture onto the sea ice if you were careful, once you know it was fairly solid. But the dogs were, they didn't have a good leader. You know, not like the professional dog teams, if you like. They were dogs that were really old and a bit rheumaticy, and you did the best you could. Sometimes you'd have to lead them,
yeah,
which is a bit frowned upon.
Did he ever get bored during the winter?
No, I don't think so. There's plenty to read, a nice library. The pilots stayed there that winter. They wintered as well. They weren't flying anywhere. They were good company. And two pilots and two mechanics. Yeah, it was good.
And then spring came along.
Yeah.
So what was the job next spring?
Well, I said to Bass, all the steelwork is finished. What you want now? Because I did ask permission to go south. I said, but what you want now? You want to send down a couple of sheeters and the sheets as well to clad it. And that's how it was left at that. And it is clad now. It's a fine structure now, even now. And that friend of mine, Dan Weinstein, he was a pilot. He was flying contractors down in his own plane down to Adelaide Island, which is near Stonington Island, to build a runway. Rother a base, to build a runway. And he was taking the contractors in and out from Punta Arenas in his own plane, because he did like going to Antarctica.
But you persuaded them to let you go to Stonington?
I did, yeah.
Can you remember how that came about?
I wanted to go to a dog sledging base, and Stonington seemed to be the one.
Again, did he have to persuade anybody?
Well, he had contact with the mainland as well, the peninsula.
Did he have to persuade anybody in particular?
I don't remember having to do that, but it was Stonington for the dogs. To become a dog driver, and
so you've gone down as a steel erector,
yeah,
and you became a fully fledged FID.
It was a FID. I think we were BAS then, British Antarctic Survey, because it changed from the Falkland Islands Dependency Survey from FIDs, to British Antarctic Survey BAS.
But was it your ambition to become more versatile in the Antarctic work? Was that?
No, I was quite happy to be a dog driver.
Yeah.
Yeah, that suited me fine. And you inherit the dog teams from the guys that are going home, right? You might have only 10 days or a fortnight to unload all the ship, to revictual the base, mm-hmm. right? And at the same time, if you're going to be a dog handler, you somehow you're introduced to one of the drivers, and I was introduced to this driver, and he'll take you out with the dogs as many times as you can in this 10 days activity, you know, unloading the ship and this, that, the other. So you can see how the dogs are commanded, you know, for left and right.
Yeah.
And how they're encouraged along, how to harness them, how to make sure they're not going to fight, which is almost an impossibility. They always fight at some stage. And he'll take you as many times as you can. You'll learn the language, for turning them and stopping them and setting them off, and it's up to you then. That's your team.
So did every dog team have the same set of instructions, or did it vary from team to team?
It's the same commands. They're all the drivers.
They're universal.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, but my dog team was called the Moomins, and the nucleus of that was from two chaps on base wanted to see this. There's a penguin rookery somewhere out in the bay. It wasn't Gintu. It was king penguins, I think, which was unusual, or emperors,
yeah.
which is unusual at that latitude.
Yeah.
And so these, I wasn't there then, this happened before. And they set off to go and find this island. And the weather blew up and the cloud came in and it was all clagged out. But they'd gone onto the sea ice to set off. And it blew for about 48 hours, I believe. And then when it cleared, the sea ice had gone out. It had all broken away. And these two teams were on the sea ice. They were never found. But what happened over the next month or two, dogs came, the odd dog, a pair of dogs, drifted back on ice floes as the ice floes came back to the beach, the coast. And they were the three of those dogs were the nucleus of the Moomins. This was taken before this happened before I went down. That was previous years. And they formed the Moomins. They formed the Moomins from the escapees from the sea ice, breakup of the sea ice. Mm.
Okay. So who did you inherit the Moomins from?
Do you know, I can't remember his name. I really
Jim.
Can't.
Okay.
Can't remember his name at all.
What was that process like? Was it a delicate process, or were you just thrown in the deep end? Were you nurtured?
No, you go out with him as many times as you can in the 10 days of the ship. Relieving the base, you'll go out as many as you can, so he can teach you the words, he can show you how you stop them fighting when they start to fight, because they will always fight. You know, if the leader was, she was a bitch, she was a beautiful dog. There she is there.
Is it Dot? Dot,
yeah. Beautiful dog. And a tremendous good leader. In the end, I could turn her just a few degrees by how loud I shouted to her. The terms were Irra for left and Auk for right. And if I whispered it, she'd just move a degree to the side. Yeah, it was amazing. And if I gave her a good shout, she'd go well to the left or well to the right.
Do you know where the words came from? Was it Eskimo?
I think it was from the Inuit community. I believe so, but I never did find out. And I used to go out as often as I could, even when the ship left, because you have to train, you have to be in control, you have to know how to harness them, make sure the harnesses are going to be a nice, tight fit, because you can lose them down a crevasse, which did happen.
We'll come to it, yeah.
And the dogs get to know you, they get to know what they can't do, because you used to have to wade into a fight, because two or three would be, and you get an injured dog, who can't run, so you lose one of your power unit and you carry him on the sledge and stick another 90 pounds on the sledge. So you try to separate them as quickly as possible, shouting and swearing. You have a thumper, rope thumper, which sounds a bit cruel, but it's an inch manila rope, which is backspliced, and it's a loop, and it's all bound up at the end, and that hangs on the handlebar, the vertical handlebar. And if they fight, you know, you have to get in amongst them, kicking, really, and beating the aggressors and making them all settle down.
So was that a case of showing them who was boss?
Yes, that I believe it was, yeah. That's how it was put over to us. You know, you've got to make them dogs do what you want to do. Mm-hmm. And it does work in the end. It does work in the end.
They don't build up any resentment?
No. If Dot was on heat and she stopped for a pee quickly, you couldn't get the other dogs past it. It would be one big pile up, one big fight, where she stopped. And that was a real bundle, it really was. You have to get in shouting. We had moccasins, Inuit moccasins, actually, and they're quite soft footwear. It's not like kicking them hard with a very heavy boot.
10 days doesn't seem very long to learn every trick in the trade.
It isn't, no, but you've got to face it and go out yourself then.
Yeah.
You don't have to take the whole team, because you can't manage seven dogs, let alone nine dogs, if you're still learning. So you take three with a little road round the base, the leader and a pair. Then you put another pair on, take five dogs, and just build it up till what you feel confident with.
So the team that you had, the Moomins,
yes.
Three of them were from this previous team.
That's from that debacle when the two lost on the ice floes.
Where did the rest come from?
The rest, Where did the rest come from? See, I'd already the Moomins were already there when I got there. I know those. I know there were three dogs that came back in on the ice, and the others were maybe scratch dogs from where you could
But they were, you inherited an experienced team.
I did, yeah, yeah, I did.
Yeah. So it was you that was learning, not them.
It was me, yes. Yeah. The driver took me out as often as he could, and then I'd say, you wouldn't take the whole team at once. You'd take five, a leader and four, and two pairs. Then you might just add another pair later on. You'd take a bit of a load, and you'd take it up onto the Northeast Glacier.
Okay.
And train up there.
You're doing lots of miles with sledges, weren't you?
Well, I think we had a 1,000-mile dog sledge journey over the peninsula, up the infamous Soda Bread Slope, and it's about I think it's about 7,000 feet on the plateau, and it's a horrendous climb up, and it's a horrendous drop off the other side to get onto the ice shelf at the other side where we did lay a depot.
Does this Soda Bread also have another name?
It does, yeah. It's Sodomy Slope.
Okay, yeah. So tell me about your first few trips. Tell me about that 1,000-mile trip, because that was a...
Well, that was surveying on the Larsen Ice Shelf. Right. We have to lay a depot all the way up at the top of Soda Bread Slope. You're backwards and forwards, as much gear as the dogs can carry. But you have to push. Well, I'll just show you just briefly. There's...
If you sit back again, where you were, and I'll come to you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
That's repaired when the handlebars went over. That's repairing the handlebars when they turned over. They're the Moomins there.
That's John Killingbeck.
Yeah, that's John Killers, yeah, with the Counties. They're the Moomins. That's John Cunningham, who's dead now, with the Admirals. And these two are the Moomins.
Mm. In 62?
In 61, 62. I was down there 1960. Finished the hangar for the next season. So that's 61. This was on Deception.
That's
I
right.
didn't until I got down to Stonington. There are the dogs there. That's the kind of terrain that you're going into. The base is there. That's the base there.
Yeah.
This is the Northeast Glacier. And the route of the Northeast Glacier, you go up there, head for that Walton Peak, and around there. And Soda Bread is up there.
Right. And these are your own photographs from the early
60s? Not necessarily, no. That was John Cunningham. He was, he got killed in a climbing accident. Not down there, in England. So that's the terrain that we would be travelling on.
Oh, yeah, this is from your own album.
This is, yeah. Well, I that's the base there.
Yeah.
There. Oh, no, this is the base. This is the island. That's Stonington Island. And it's linked... It's not linked now because of global warming.
Yeah,
that's been cut back right to there now. It's surrounded just open water. But that ramp there was always there when we were there. That took us up onto the... There's Northeast Glacier there, which is up there. And then all up here. That's Soda Bread Slope, Sodomy Slope. And that bends around to there and onto the plateau.
Let's talk a bit more about this 1,000-mile trip then. Because obviously it was significant because...
It was
your first major trip, wasn't it?
Yeah, I went as a dog driver and a minder to look after the geologists because they were geologising all the way up the coast.
That was the purpose of the trip, was it?
Yes, it was. It was a scientific thing, yes, really. Not being a scientist, I was just, we were just the ones that went with them, so that they could... So they could get onto the rock face and they move along, and there's someone there with them.
So what was it like then, this 1,000 miles? I mean, you were away from base for quite some time.
Yeah, we were. Yeah, about 3 months, I think it was.
The two of you?
No, we had three teams.
Three teams in parallel.
In line.
Yeah.
The dogs will always follow another team. And so that's sparing the other dogs too much work, so they'll follow easily, very easily. It's leading a team, being the leader of a convoy, if you like. It's the leader that takes the brunt of the work. He's got to keep his dogs going.
Yeah.
yeah. whether you're coming in soft snow or icy snow or whatever. You know, you've got to lead through any condition. It might be deep snow, whereas you're pushing as well as the dog's pulling.
Yeah. Okay. And the specimens were going on the back of the sledge, and that was making them heavier?
Or depot, because we had the Avalon otters that were at Deception, and they'd fly in and pick up the samples, which were in sledging boxes.
So you're being serviced all the way around, really?
Well, yeah, wherever the airplanes can get in, and as long as they know where the depot is. Mm-hmm. But now they'll... that's how they do it now, I think. You know, they'll go in and collect what the geologists have put together and bring them back to base, and then they'll analyse them.
Was this the trip where the incident occurred?
Yes.
Tell me the story.
On the way back.
You were almost back home, weren't you?
Yeah, we came back home, came back down to Three Slice Nun Attack, which is right over the, straight over the peninsula there. Base is here. Over the top of the peninsula, down on the other side, Three Slice Nun, at sea level. Mm-hmm. The route up to the top of the plateau from the Three Slice Nun Attack is called, they call it Bill's Gulch, and it's quite heavily crevassed. So you're pushing all your load up Bill's Gulch, right, watching for crevasses and stuff like this. Onto the top, by the time of that, you're ready to camp anyway, you know. So you'd be in your pyramid tent. You camp, you'd eat, sleep, and get off the next day. So you've got to get to the top then of Soda Bread, which is on the other side. The Mormons were very good at leading. You know, they were a strong team, and I think I probably led a lot, most of the way maybe. That's a bit, you know, a bit boastful, but all the teams led in, you know, in turn. But mine was very strong in leading. They've got a good, strong team.
Okay, so we were talking about this incident, the near tragedy. Aren't
yeah,
we?
That's so up Bill's Gulch on top of the plateau, heading towards the top of Soda Bread, right? So you all get to the top of Soda Bread, three teams, right? So it was my turn to lead down. It's the snow. It was soft snow as well. So having gone up Soda Bread, I knew which way down it was. The tracks had gone from when we came up. So I know it's quite a steep curve when you just leave the top, right? And then it batters out a bit. Then you have to turn to the right to stay away from a big ice cliff and wander down that way. You've wrapped rope around the sledge runners, thick rope. That they will help to act as a brake, because a loaded sledge will catch the dogs up if the surface is bit slippery, and it'll run into them, which is, you don't want that. It could injure the dogs. And I said to the two teams behind me, I said, give me 10-15 minutes to get to the bottom of this first slope, right? Take the rope brakes off, which are wrapped around the runners, to stop it overrunning the dogs. And I knew we had to traverse round the bowl above Soda Bread to start to drop down Soda Bread itself, because that's the way we came up. And so I took the rope brakes off after I'd gone over the top, and I set off traversing along. And then the next team came over and waited for the other one that came over. They're behind me, a fair way behind me. And I'm travelling along, contouring, trying to get round, you know, the sledge slipping sideways. You've got keels, you can put keels down through the runners, and that will help that. But they were going sideways. The dog's partially pulling uphill, going forward at an angle. Then all of a sudden, Dot disappeared.
Did you know there were crevasses around?
I know, yeah, but they didn't know where they were. Right. You know, it was a semi-white out, and if the visibility is good, you can see where the snow bridge might be just hollow, it might be sinking. But I didn't see this. It was semi-white out. Things, the sky's merging with the ground. And all of a sudden, Dot disappeared, and then the pair behind her, they disappeared as well, and then zip zip, they all went down, right?
All nine.
Or did I have nine then? Or was it, I had seven, eight, or nine. It depends how many you've got. I think I had seven at that stage, right, after the long journey. And the sledge was then pointing uphill, and it was almost on the edge of the crevasse, almost at right angles, not running with it, because the sledge has been slipping down the slope at the same time. So I pulled the sledge over, shout to the guy I was with, pull it over and make sure it's not going to slide. So we pull it over and it can't drag. I kind of crawled to the end of this trace and I looked down, because I thought they'd all gone. And I looked down, my eyes got used to it, and there they all were, hanging in the harnesses. Because we make our own harnesses from Lampwick and make them snug, good, strong fit, so they don't fall out. And they were all hanging right down at the bottom of this, not in the bottom of the crevasse, in mid-air.
Yeah.
So the other teams have come following in my tracks now. So I shouted to them, come down from above, take the load off, picket the dogs, push the sledge over the crevasse, right? And I'll go down and pull them out one at a time. Which he did.
So
did
the sledge formed a bridge, did it?
The sledge formed a bridge right above where the trace disappeared.
Right.
And they lowered me down on a rope. I didn't have any Jumar stirrups. They lowered me down on a rope, round the sledge.
You volunteer, I presume, did you?
Oh, yeah, well, I had to do the business there. You know, it wasn't brave or anything. I was desperate to get the dogs out. And I got down to the back pair. And we're all, you know, oh, two of them were fighting in midair. Yeah, two of them were already fighting. But I'm shouting. Anyway, I got down to the back pair, right? And I said, send me your rope down with the carabiner on. I'll click it on the harness, take the one off, pull it up and keep repeating. And, what was the other thing? Before I got all this snow bridge set up, I kept looking down because there were two fighting in midair. And lo and behold, when I looked a second or a third time, they disappeared. They had actually fallen out of the harnesses.
They wriggled out, haven't
they? Yeah. Well, pulled each other out, I suppose. And I thought, well, they've gone. You know, this, I couldn't see them any, you know, I can almost see Dot down there. But it was Angus, I can't remember. It was a McGraw and another one, I can't remember. That's my wife, I think. And anyway, they dropped me down, pulled each dog out in turn. I clicked them on, and I got down to Dot. And I said to her, well, there you are, Dot. And, you know, you've fallen the farthest. And there. And I went down to, and I looked down, and there was a big block of ice wedged in the crevasse. And on this ice, the two that had fallen out, there was soft snow on top. They'd fallen, and they were like, they weren't fighting anymore. They were lying quietly there. And I thought, blimey, you know, I'm going to get them all. And sent them all up in turn, then went down to the other two. And one of them was called Eccles. He was a big, big dog. And I put a harness on his two front legs and a harness on his two back legs, put them both together, and he went up. with his back hollow, because he would have fallen out, and we got them all up like that.
How deep down was the deepest dog, would you say?
That's been asked a few times. The length of the trace plus another 20 feet.
Right.
So whatever I've quoted in that little story, it's got to be the length, 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 feet. It's just a wild guess.
All right. And you spoke to the dogs, did you?
They were quiet. When, you know, all hanging in the harness, and Eccles and Aramis were, it was Eccles and Coco, I can't remember his name, were down in the, fallen on this, and they were lying quiet. They weren't fighting. And like I said, they sent each dog up singly, and they pulled them all out. And then, because I hadn't got any Jumar stirrups, I think I had crampons on, and I can't remember now. And the guys up top just gradually hauled me up.
Did you think you were being brave?
No, I wasn't frightened at all. It had to be done. And you have to do it.
What were the dogs like when you got back to them?
My wife, yeah.
Like, I think we'll be a little bit. I'll give you a shout. All right. What were the dogs? What was the mood amongst the dogs when you got them back up again?
Oh, quiet.
They realised it had.
Yeah, they're quiet. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So we took the sledge bridge away, and I forget who it was now. Whose sledge it was? They shoved the sledge back to where they'd come down to. They picketed the dogs, and then they went and loaded their sledge up. And in the meantime, I've got mine back away from the crevasse and picketed, and all the load tied on safely, and then harnessed the dogs up and just waited till everybody was ready.
So you were more or less back on the road quite quickly after that, were you?
Yes, I didn't cross any more crevasses. I didn't see any more crevasses. I didn't see that one that we fell in, that the team fell in.
And were you home the same evening?
Yes, we were. Yeah. We got there the same. Didn't have to camp.
In your bunk that night, thinking back over the day, did you have a different view on it all? Did you realise that you were lucky or unlucky or?
Well, I was unlucky, and it was. It could have happened to anybody, and I was mightily relieved, because the dogs led. The Mummies led all the way back as well. Mm. They were a good team. They were a good team. I was lucky to have a team like that.
And they were lucky to have you.
I was enthusiastic, and I did love the dogs. I cried buckets when they left. Mm. You know, they were on the spans, and I was very, very tearful, saying goodbye to them all. And we raise pups as well. You know, a bitch can come on heat, and you have to breed a few young pups to grow up into take place of the old timers when they get too arthritic. Mm. So
they did, in fact, perish eventually, didn't they?
Yes, they did. And another team who I can't remember the name of, and two men. That was on the year after I left.
In 66?
66, yeah. I think.
Where were you when you heard about that?
I was at home.
In Yorkshire?
Yeah, I'd come home, yeah.
Do you remember this?
I don't remember who. I can't remember at all.
Yeah. What was your feeling?
Well, it was dreadful. I mean, the two men were found, after a long search, the two men were found. One was in a snow hole dug behind the sledge. And he was standing, apparently frozen to death. Oh, should I be saying all this? In the attitude of calling for his mate, or his mate would appear to be, he was going out to see how the dogs were faring. That's how I read
the
it.
The Mummies.
Yeah. No, there were two teams.
Oh, two teams.
Yeah, two teams. Because the dogs, they'll curl up and they go to sleep, and they can freeze to the ice. And, you know, they can't get up. And if they're covered, they suffocated. That can happen. That's what happened to the two teams, and the two men. One was his body was found between the snow hole and the dogs. He'd never made it to the dogs, and the dogs were frozen and suffocated and buried, and the guy in the snow holes was shouting to his mate in bad conditions, in blizzard conditions.
Were you?
I wasn't there then.
No, but you were home. Hearing about it back home.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about your relationship with the dogs. Were you very upset by the loss of the dogs?
Yes, I was, yeah. Yeah.
Or did the men mean more to you?
Oh, well, I didn't know the men. I didn't know the men at all. But, you know, losing two men is, and losing a dog team is a bit traumatic. Mm. I wouldn't say I put the loss of the men before the dogs.
Okay.
It's a horrible thing to happen.
It is, absolutely, yes.
But they'll keep curled up in a blizzard, and they can freeze down to the, you know, because they've got very thick coats, and they'll generate warmth, and then they get cold, and they'll not be able to stand up.
What were the other highlights of your time at
Stonington?
Stonington, yeah.
Well, it's mainly sledging, really, you know. Going out onto the sea ice during good weather, to bring in the seals that are lying there for the dog feed during the winter. You drag the car, you'd stun a seal, and then you'd cut its throat, cut it open, open it up, pull all the giblets out and things. Then you turn it on its back, put a hole through its jaw, and you tow it back to base to put on the seal pile. On the seal pile, you'd split it into three, each side of the spine, and then you've got three nice long lengths of meat to chop up for the weekly feed, if you like, the twice weekly feed.
For the dogs?
Yeah.
And the humans?
We used to take a little bit of... I think we had a heart at some time. I'm not certain whether we had a liver, but we tried... We always took a nice piece out of the back. Mm. And where we was cooking, it was okay, it was fine.
How did you feel about doing it? Because it wasn't exactly in the job description, was it, for a steel erector to have to start dismembering seals?
You only picked it up from the guys that are there.
But you stuck to it quite well?
Oh, yeah, quite well, yeah. Yeah. You would stun the seal... Mm. You know, because when get up to them, they do rear up a little bit frightened. And you could do with your flat of an ice axe at the flat blade at the top, not the pick side, but flat blade. And you could stun it. And then you could cut the throat and let it bleed, cut the windpipe. And then you'd slice it down and pull all the intestines out and you'd leave them on the ice. And then you'd drag it back to base.
So you weren't queasy at all about it?
I never liked it. I didn't enjoy killing seals, and it's a bloody mess, and that's what you did for the dogs. Well, I was still having problem with a slip disc every now and again. It was quite painful, but I did manage it, and it did ache quite a bit at Sydney.
Is that what made you come back, do you think? The slip disc.
Well, I was casivac'd out. I did lay in Stanley Hospital towards the end, waiting for a transport back home, which finished up with I think it was a Norwegian ship that had brought passengers down and cargo, and all the way back on there, met in Southampton, and taken into Southampton Hospital and had a plaster cast put on. And then they drove me back home and left me.
So what happened to you? I mean, there's a big gap then in your Antarctic career from 66 to 90. How did you fill those years? Did you recover first?
Well, I met my wife, you know.
Right.
I met my wife and I was going for physiotherapy. And my wife's a physiotherapist. And
is that how you met her?
That's how we met, yes.
She was treating you?
Yeah.
Kathy?
Well, yeah. Not Kathy all the time because it was quite a big school, but... we got to know each other quite well, and I got better, and I got a job on with the seismic company, doing seismic survey in the North Sea, with detonators and putting a pattern of waves down into the seabed, and that paid very, very good money. Once I got fit, it wasn't heavy work as such.
Were you doing that for all this time, for 20 odd years?
Oh, no. No, I only did it for about 3 or 4 years, I think. They wanted me... I've never got onto a rig. I wanted to get on a rig. And I'd have been offered a place on a rig. But I said... So I told the survey, Seismograph Services, SSL, that I was going to leave and go on the rig. He said, well, look... What about going on a down to West Africa for us, you know, with the recording boat and a catamaran for sending the charges off? Mm-hmm. So that sounded interesting. So I went to the Cameroons and did a survey there with on the explosive side. I don't know how long I was there, 2 months or whatever. And Kathy, she did say, we were writing to each other at that stage, and she did say that there's a chance she could come to South Africa for work. And I said, well, you know, I shall be coming back in a month. It'll all be over in a month's time. And so she waited. Yeah. I was cured by then, you know, obviously.
What other kind of work do you do in the interim then? Because
I got better by taking on some light jobs. Fiberglass, making fiberglass bin liners, you know, from a mould. Two brothers, you know, I went to work for two brothers and they showed me how to lay these all up, and it was light work. And I gradually got better. And then I left there. What did I do then? Oh, I went for the rat catcher's job in Sheffield. I did indeed. And the council, I did say that I'd had a slip disc problem years ago, and you know, I said, but I'm fine now. And the Umdenarden, he says, well, we feel as though all these manhole covers you're going to have to lift off to go and poison the rats. They said, no, well, I'm sorry, we can't offer you the job.
Mention one or two other highlights in your, before we go back to the Antarctic, in the work you did.
Highlights in the work.
Whilst you were back here, between your two big trips.
Well, it was on the seismic boat on the North Sea.
Right, that was the main work.
Yeah. I was earning very, very good money. And on one of the periods on leave in Sheffield, I went and bought a brand new Triumph Spitfire straight out of the showroom. It was, you know, the pain was that good. And Cathy and I went round the Ring of Kerry for a holiday in Ireland.
So what was it that got you tempted to go back to the Antarctic then?
We went to the Royal Geographical Society, and I got talking to a chap I'd never met before, but he was from Bass, and he got talking about Halley Bay. And they're building, it's a jackable platform. You jack it up and the snow fills up over the winter, and then you jack it up again to keep it clear underneath. So you're not where the old huts that were fixed to the ice, the snow, they would get buried slowly, and then they would be crushed. So when you're jacking a platform up, you know you're beating the, you put extensions on the legs, 20 legs, 20 steel stanchions. And that you jack them all, you have two men on every stanchion, and you're jacking these things on a worm wheel, you know, ever so slowly.
So you went to Halley in just for a couple of months in early 1990.
Did I?
Do that kind of work?
Yes, I did.
And you were back again the following summer?
Yeah, I think I was. I went there at least three times, I think.
Yeah.
And we could drive snowcats as well, if there was short of snowcat drivers, unloading the ship, taking all the cargo inland to the base, which was probably, you know, quite a distance.
At one point, you were sleeping in a tent inside the house.
Oh, yeah, it was covered over with snow, yeah. Well, we were cooking as well. Al Weirden was a cook, and we lived below the snow line. We thought we'd over below the snow level.
At
Halley, yeah.
Underneath the ground?
The snow would accumulate, and it would blow, it would cover. And that was it. We weren't buried as such. You know, you could climb out at either end, up a hatch, up a runway.
Right. There was a famous, or perhaps a better word is infamous, trip called, according to this, K-16, which I know nothing about. Tell me about that.
K-16, going back to the ship.
That's right.
Oh, that was a hilarious one.
Go on, tell me the story.
Well, we'd all finished at Halley Bay. All the cargo that was going to the ship was going, and we had a snowcat, and there were three or four of us, half a dozen of us, and we had a case of beer, and we were having a smashing time, great time. You know, we finished, been hard work, been a hard season, and we had a few cans of beer on the way to the ship. And the first mate, he saw us, and you're supposed to drive with the hatch open in case you'd fall in a crack or anything, and you're supposed to get out. We hadn't done that, and we just jumped out on the sea ice when it got to the end, and he says, "What, you know, are you all having a death wish?" But, you know, that was K-16, I think, was it?
That was the story, was it?
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, right.
It's not about an accident and blokes getting killed, is it? That one?
I don't think so.
No, it was. That was the trip back, the last snowcat back.
The last snowcat of that season.
Of that season, yeah.
Right, and the beer. Okay, yeah. Were you conscious all the time of health and safety in that period, or was it all a bit?
Well, I'm health and safety, yeah. You've got to be sensible about it. I like to think I'm sensible, but it can get a bit of a nuisance. It can be, you know. Being a steeplejack, you've got to be a little bit, you've got to do it right. Being a steel erector, you've got to do it right. And whatever you do it, or whatever you know, you're not going to fall off or whatever. You know, I never really bothered. Well, I do bother, but I've never really been frightened of that.
But your background was hugely methodical.
It was scaffolding
work, wasn't it?
Yes, scaffolding. Well, yeah, particularly with the steeplejacking. Because it wasn't steeples, it was industrial chimneys. And you have to put your own pegs in and your own ladders. And that's a bit of an eye-opener. You see, you get used to it, but yeah, that's a bit. Now, when you get to the top as well, where there's usually steel bands all the way around the top 10 feet, if you've got to maintain any stonework at the top, bricks or whatever, you have to pull these inch diameter, you pull from a pulley block to the guy down below. He pulls them up on a pulley, and you take they've got a ring like that, and they go like that. The width of a chimney at the top may be about that, right?
About two,
and you hook these over, right? And you've got this to get enough of those round so you can go down in a bosun's chair and inspect all the mortars and all that and repair it and everything like that. You have to stand on the bands, from your ladders that you've put the ladders in. And the bands are only half inch thick. And you stand holding onto the hangers and you're pushing them forward and you're shuffling around on these bands till you get where you want to be. Put a bosun's chair on, sit on it, and you lower yourself down and just examine what's what. Do what needs to be done.
And did you? So you would you say you were more health and safety conscious in the Antarctic than your colleagues because of your careful background?
I just enjoyed what I did. Yeah, I was conscious about falling in the tide crack or falling in or putting a leg through into a crevasse. You know, this that and business.
Were you a risk taker?
I was probably a little bit inclined that way, yes. Probably, yeah.
And you got away with it?
I got away with it, yeah. I mean, the dog team falling down a crevasse, that was a bit traumatic. I didn't see that coming at all. Mm-hmm. It was semi-whiteout conditions. You don't have a horizon at all.
Mm-hmm. Shall we take a break?
Yeah, if you like, yeah.
Come back and do some more. Thank you.